This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. For decades, hip-hop culture has produced music that is commercially successful and socially relevant. You can go back to Nas' seminal album, Illmatic, from 1994. Creative lyrics, visceral imagery portraying life in the streets of New York. Or Beyoncé's visual album, Lemonade, released last year. It weaves hip-hop, pop, and black feminism. And for some time now, hip-hop has been the subject of academic study. On today's installment of Back Channel, we'll talk about the relationship between hip-hop and academia. Joining me as always, Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. Mark is a professor of African and African American Studies at Duke University, an author and the host of the webcast Left of Black. Welcome back, Mark.
How are you doing, Frank?
And Natalie Bullock Brown, a professor of film and broadcast media at St. Augustine's University in Raleigh. Hello, Natalie.
Hello, Frank.
Mark, let me ask you about this relationship between hip-hop and the academy. Is it a strong? I mean, is it? There's always this question about pop culture and whether or not it belongs at all in the walls of the academy. Tell us about the relationship.
Well, you know, jazz has been in the conservatories since the early 1960s, right? We've been doing jazz studies for 50 years. The first book that kind of gestures towards academics and hip-hop, you know, David Toop's Rap Attack, was published in 1984. Houston Baker's Hip-Hop in the Academy was published in 1993. And then Trisha Rose's Black Noise, which everybody kind of sees as a seminal beginning of hip-hop studies, was published in 1994. Right? So we're talking about something that's more than 20 years old. The fact that at virtually every major institution there's someone teaching courses on hip-hop studies, and not just kind of like a general history of it, but, you know, stuff around Southern studies. Ninth Wonder and I have been teaching our class here at Duke now for 7 years, History of Hip-Hop. We have 139 students this semester. I think the point where you have to validate whether or not this is legitimate has long been gone. Folks use hip-hop studies as they might use jazz studies or so many other kinds of quote-unquote pop culture studies as a portal, you know, to talk about issues around culture and history and politics. And that's what's happening with hip-hop studies, obviously, now also.
Right. And, you know, I think about that. I guess the first person that I heard was sort of incorporating hip hop into the academy was Tony Blackman, who is a well-known poet and academician. And then I think about someone like Regina Bradley, who was recently at Duke, whose research is very is immersed in looking at trap music and issues around gender and other areas. And then I also think about someone like Byron Hurt, who made a film that was released in 2006 called Hip Hop Beyond Beats and Rhymes, and to this day is still used in the academy. So I think it has, for a very long time, been well integrated.
Well, A.D. Carson may have taken it to a new level. He is a PhD candidate at Clemson University, and for his dissertation, A.D. decided to do something different. He made a 34-track rap album. The project explores issues of police brutality and mass incarceration and looks at the relationship between hip-hop and the academy. Let's listen.
Since I'm in a position to talk to these kids and they listen, I ain't an academic, but I kick it with them a minute. You see, I teach and I rap, and some people call it a gimmick, but I never thought it was different. Just got in where I fit, it's not rocket science. If I am most inspired by poems and then I write them, how can I be expected to go on and live without it?
That's a clip from the song S.A.T. from A.D. Carson's album and dissertation called Owning My Masters, The Rhetorics of Rhymes and Revolutions. And A.D. Carson joins us now to talk about his project. A.D., welcome.
Oh, hey, how's it going?
It's going good. Tell us about the origins of this album. Why did you decide to do this project?
Word. Well, yeah, I thought that, I was always recording music and engaging in these academic spaces or trying to like be a bridge in the community where I was between the academy, the community, and the high school. And when I saw the rhetorics, communication and information program down at Clemson, then I thought, well, one of the things that I really want to be able to do if I'm going to go into this PhD program is to continue to do this kind of work, but to make sure that the work is still focused on the ways that I like to present. And, you know, those happen to be through rap and poetry.
No, I understand, though, that this project, your dissertation did start out as a more conventional kind of dissertation, and at some point along the way, you just had this epiphany and said, no, wait a minute, this needs to be an album. Am I right about that?
Yeah, I mean, I thought that I was going to do an album and then use something like, you know, like Adam Bradley has this book of rhymes where, you know, in one of the chapters, he kind of goes through these literary terms. He's talking about what rappers are doing. And then at some point in my reading, like particularly dealing with like the histories of rhetoric, I just kind of thought, well, maybe I need to look at this a little bit differently and not focus so much on attempting to tell other rappers or to learn myself and then tell other rappers what they're doing, but to really like kind of look at what we're doing and how that might contribute to this conversation or these conversations that have been going on for a really long time.
Well, so tell us about this, because I think this project looks at some of the perceptions and the voices and the ways in which power and narratives about power are voiced. The hip-hop culture has one way of framing that story. The Academy, I think, famously has another way. Talk about the intersection, then, of this album as an academic project and the voices that you're trying to create as you do this project.
Yeah, well, you know, another thing that you know, I come across in the reading is like somebody like Sylvia Winter, who talks about how people are storytellingly invented, and the ways that we, you know, like we are products of the stories that we tell ourselves about ourselves. And so if I'm a product of, you know, if I'm a product of hip hop, and hip hop is the way that, you know, that I define certain characteristics, you know, like aspects of my personality, and then somehow I'm translating my voice into, you know, like a more proper form in order to have this academic conversation. But the academic conversation is about hip hop. And, you know, I keep finding myself shifting back and forth. Mm. Or, you know, I'm being asked to translate myself in order to be legible inside the academy. Then, you know, there's a certain kind of violence that's going on whenever I'm translating myself. Or when I'm asked to do that and then I concede, or when I present myself as a rapper or, you know, through rap, and then someone says I can't understand that, as though the words that I'm saying don't make sense. And we know that the words make sense. We know that people have been engaging with hip hop and that they've been studying it. As was stated earlier, you know, many universities have been critically engaging with hip hop texts. So, you know, how do we then engage with the hip hop artist, or how do we engage with the hip hop art? How do we engage with hip hop scholarship that looks like this, as opposed to the other ways that that we have been engaging with it?
Mark, forgive me for interrupting, AD, but I wanted to ask Mark Anthony Neal sort of what impact projects like this can have on the Academy and the way it approaches its research and its presentation.
You know, it's part of a moment where folks are beginning to rethink what the academic pursuit is on the one hand, but also what the byproduct of this is. As you're looking at filmmakers going through MFA programs, you have creative writers, you have folks who are doing born digital projects, you know, that just aren't going to be simply rendered as a book anymore. So this is firmly within that tradition. I think what's also important that when you think about the relationship that young folks have to hip hop and how it's presented to them, and this idea of the mixtape, whether it's a physical mixtape or, you know, something that's more virtual, it makes sense to do this kind of project in the very kind of media platform that young folks would access it. It's also, I think, critically important that when that we're talking about hip hop or other forms of vernacular culture, that at some point you have to be able to present vernacular culture in the vernacular, okay. Right? You know, folks have to hear it. Yeah. Right. And, you know, as great as Adam Bradley's project was in terms of, you know, being able to create all these lyrics, or we can go back to Angela Davis's book, you know, Blues Legacies and the lyrics of black women blues singers. At some point, you have to hear this stuff to hear it in the context in which it was intended.
Natalie?
I was going to say also that, you know, there is sort of a debate, I'll call it, within the Academy about, you know, whether or not the work of scholars is meant for, like, are we public scholars or are we scholars that are firmly entrenched within the academy and we're only going to speak that language? And I think the benefit of what AD is doing is that it is clearly public, and he is he's translating something that would typically, you know, like the dissertation and the PhD project is typically something that most people don't feel like they have access to. Right. So the fact that he is basically taking his dissertation to the streets is, you know, I think it speaks to this need, really, for scholarship to become public and accessible in ways that it hasn't been before.
There's that. And AD, let me ask you another question, because you're also taking it back to the Academy and something that Mark said earlier, and I think you referenced as well. It's a way, is it not, of telling the Academy that look, the way you've been structuring knowledge, the way you've been structuring narratives is itself a form of power. And so in order to accept a change in the power structure, you're going to have to accept a way, change in the way we narrate the story.
Yeah, it's definitely true. I mean, I thought, and, you know, like I should say at this point, well, really, I want to thank Mark, because there was a point in time when I was having this struggle trying to articulate that in one of my my pre-dissertation studios. And we had a Skype session where we really talked about accessing the archive and what the archive looks like and who has access to it or where it is. And we had this really interesting conversation about Nas and Kool G Rap that that I was able to record. And being able to have that conversation and then present that in that studio to the professor, then it started to make sense to the person who I was trying to have that conversation with. Because I was having a conversation with the scholar who really was deeply invested and understood what I was like, the question that I was trying to ask and the answer that I was trying to get toward, and so that was really, really helpful to be able to have that conversation with him. So I just want to say thanks for that.
We're going to take a break right here and hear the results of that dissertation and talk a little more deeply about this with A.D. Carson on this month's installment of Back Channel, a doctoral candidate from Clemson, also Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest on today's program of Back Channel, Mark Anthony Neal, Natalie Bullock Brown in this episode. And we're also talking with Clemson doctoral candidate A.D. Carson about his doctoral dissertation, which was itself a hip-hop rap album. And why don't we play a clip from that that dissertation called Dissertation.
Because you read it in the book, thought that it was true. Yep. Saw it on the television, thought that it was you. Self-fulfilling politics, get talked to you at school. Brawler, cause you brought with it a positively rude. Mind state, I keep mine like a blind date. I can be objective, I can be accepting, but I'd rather be selective. If I'm not respected, I'm the wrong nigga to F with. If you saw my checklist, you knew this was next. It's not a matter of simply rapping. I really happen to have a strategy being enacted. If you know, you know, I ain't afraid of spitting. What I know is true, cause I'm selling for the Mason Dixon. If I know the truth, it's my duty to make revisions. Showing my people's beauty and skewing what they envision. I make my living off the things that I think. Therefore I am. I'll give that a minute to sink. Still hoping for some healing from this place.
A clip from the song Dissertation from A.D. Carson's album Owning My Masters. He joins us along with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal on Back Channel today. Tell us more about constructing the album itself and what you were going for in writing these songs and producing them, putting them on the album, A.D.
Yeah, well, when I started out, you know, once I got to Clemson, I just started writing as things were going on. But again, this is the way that I've kind of always dealt with whatever is happening in my life as I write music. And so I was writing lyrics as I was taking, doing all of my classwork. And of course, then that's going to influence the stuff that I'm writing. And so over the course of those first 8 semesters, I just recorded a mixtape, I mean, a collection of those particular recordings over the course of each semester, and had those to be able to submit as mixtape essays over the course of each semester. And then from that, I put together the master playlist.
And at the same time, you're talking about the impact of the music itself, both the way it has shaped American culture and the impact of American culture on hip hop itself. And so there becomes this kind of meta narrative that you're creating with it. And of course, there's a fair amount of text that goes along with the album, right?
Yeah, what I ended up turning into my committee was 279 pages, and then there was a 37-page digital booklet that was, you know, it also included some pictures and all kinds of other things that I was doing. So I also shot some videos and things.
Sam, we've been talking about your dissertation, Owning My Masters, 34-track album, You also look at hip-hop's relationship to the Academy, and you're talking about that. We talked about that a little bit earlier. Many of the songs feature critiques on social issues and institutional racism, but again, use the form itself as a way of expressing the message. Let's listen to this clip from Familiar.
People surrender from coast to the cold and the whip of the lash. I never lived it, but I tell you now, boy, it's familiar. Say, boy, it's familiar. For the gangs with the chains on their hands and their ankles, it ain't just the Senko for song. For the kings with the Martin or Rodney who knew it unlikely, but ask, could we all get along? For the answer we know to that question that keep us a little suspicious. We ain't the first to have wished it. We ain't the first ones to get it. Say, boy, it's familiar.
That's a clip from Familiar from A.D. Carson's album Owning My Masters. He's with me along with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal on Back Channel today. So tell us more about, again, as you're putting these things together, it's one thing to write a song about issues that matter, socially relevant issues, and another to keep in mind that you're also trying to make a commentary on the impact of hip-hop. How did this sort of play, or how did you work with this as a scholar and a musician, in effect, as you're composing these songs?
Well, you know, like even with the song like Familiar, I'm thinking, like when I'm writing the song, I'm actually thinking about James Baldwin and him talking about us being trapped in history and history being trapped in us. And then I'm thinking, well, you know, this is a trap beat. and then thinking about how then can I really have that conversation, even if it's like sort of implied. And then if you listen to the entire song, the verses are structured very similarly to the way that Langston Hughes structures Dream Variations. And so I'm in conversations with this, not only this historical occurrences, but also like these figures who have been tackling some of these issues since, you know, far before I arrived here and started, you know, wanting to create, you know, artistic work.
Natalie, how does this work for you as an academic critique and as well as music?
As an academic critique, yeah. Well, I cannot help but make comparisons in my mind to the work of someone that both Mark and I know, and you may know him also, Frank, Dasana Hanu, also mm-hmm. known as Chris Massenburg, who was recently a hip hop scholar, as it were, at Harvard in the Nasir Jones. What's the full?
Nasir Jones Fellowship at the Du Bois Institute.
Thank you. And Chris's research was about basically trying to legitimate the lyric, the rap lyric as poetry, you know, as a literary tradition. And I feel like, you know, AD is doing, I feel like you, AD, are doing that same sort of work. And really challenging what the Academy considers legitimate right. and authentic scholarly work. But, I mean, if you just think about what he just said about having this conversation, like the way that he structured the rhymes, what he's thinking about in terms of Baldwin and Baldwin talking about history being trapped in us and our culture being trapped in history and then using a trap beat. Like that's, if that's not intellectual right. thought, you know, if that's not legitimate in terms of how he is playing around with, you know, with scholarship, really, I mean, I don't know what is. So I think it is a very effective and interesting and really provocative way of looking at and critiquing, yes, the Academy in ways that I think it needs to be critiqued.
The way, it seems to me, the way this works against academic structure and probably for the better, Mark, and I'd like to get your thoughts on this, is that it takes a kind of artistic understanding and aesthetic judgment to get all of that. In other words, the academic approach has been to objectify, stand back, not get your heart and head together so that we can pretend to have some kind of objective critique. But in order to see trap music as part of an intellectual concept of being trapped, which is a deeply abstract intellectual concept of being trapped in history and right. ourselves, requires artistic judgment as well as intellectual, which the Academy, it seems to me, has prided itself, for better or ill, on rejecting.
Well, I think about that in a different context, right? If you think about folks who are in art history departments, if you think about folks who are teaching classics, if you think about folks who are teaching, you know, American literature, English literature, they are making aesthetic judgments about what is good art. about what good literature is, right? And part of what has been the challenge of hip-hop studies, which is why, you know, in the early days, there was so much work that wanted to go back to the lyric and talk about the lyric in conversation with African-American poetry traditions and American poetry traditions, is this idea that somehow this was work that was outside acceptable aesthetic choices, right? Mm-hmm. Too much slang, too much profanity and all these kinds of things. I think the challenge that a project like AD presents is that it actually says that there is a criteria, aesthetic criteria, that has nothing to do with your Western criteria, that is valued in and of itself. And now there's actually, you know, a body of folks, a collectivity of folks who are doing this work that can validate this. And the students find it attractive and useful, and they learn stuff from it. So it's presenting a direct challenge, right? You know, I think about a kind of course that AD could teach, and he'll have 50 students in a class, and the classics professor will have 10. And given the political economy of these institutions, right, AD's always going to teach that class, right? Because it's about butts in the seats, right? And we're not making the argument that they're butts in the seat because it's a less than experience, right?
Right.
It's just a different challenge, right? A different conversation.
Well, AD, I'll get you to comment on what Mark just said, but also I'm going to take it back just one more step, because I've read art histories about art that I loved, and there was nothing in what I was reading that made me love the art. I understood it, and I was happy for it. I don't mean that the academic critique wasn't useful to me in some way of understanding the context in which this artist was working and the things they were working against, but I didn't fall in love with the painting because of what I read. There was something about the structure of the academic piece that I was looking at that I had no emotional response to. Then I went to the gallery and said, I'm better informed and now appreciate this piece more deeply. And this seems to bring the two together. So, AD, I'll get you to sort of talk about all of that, because this is your dissertation.
Yeah, I mean, well, I also, because hip-hop exists, you know, it has this life outside of the academy. And that life outside the academy is something that many of us are living and breathing. Many of us are attempting to bring it into the academy with us because it's out there and because we love it. And so you have students who have that love, and that love is a thing that they bring into those seats that their butts are in. And if it so happens that when they're on their way to that, they know that what they're going to do when they're sitting in those seats is engage with hip hop or engage through hip hop, then it makes sense that they're going to meet it with the kind of passion that they might not meet these other types of academic engagements with.
And that there are butts and heads and hearts also attached to that being. I want to play another clip, because I want to talk more about the content of this too, and again, some of the social relevance in this dissertation. This is a clip from a song called See the Stripes. Let's listen.
The sight of the most exciting 25 seconds in college football was made possible by prophets from the most shameful centuries in America's history. But come to the campus of Clemson University and you'd hardly be able to tell it from looking around. Solid orange, you'll see. The grounds are perfectly manicured, alluring, and monuments to the greatness that creates such institutions stand as reminders from whence we came, and since we gain so much from what we see, we smile. Proud of the great tradition of which we have the benefit of saying we are now a part. Solid orange we are. And it's easy to buy in. It starts with the song that shakes the Southland and a sea of solid orange, tiger rags that kind of grab you and say, you are now a member of this family. You are now a Clemson Tiger. Wear your orange proudly. But it's a pretty well-known fact that tigers have stripes, and almost as well-known as the reason they do, yet Clemson University, home of the Tigers, doesn't do much acknowledging of those dark marks it knows to be so integral a part of its existence. Solid orange, we say, at this university that was once a plantation, slavery being a positive good according to Master Calhoun, whose house sits still on a plot atop a hill overlooking the football field. Open 7 days a week, and I can even enter through the front door.
Here we go. A clip from See the Stripes from A.D. Carson's album, Owning My Masters. A.D. Carson is with me today on Back Channel, along with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. So break that one down for us. You got to start with the most exciting 25 seconds in football, because we here in North Carolina might not know what you're talking about.
Word. So the... you know, like at the beginning of the Clemson football games, the football players, they come from the locker room and then they drive around and then they run down this hill after they rub this rock that they call Howard's Rock. And you know, Brett Musburger, I believe is the guy's name. Musburger, I don't know his first name.
Yeah, that's him. But, that's him.
Yeah, he says it's the, you know, the most exciting 25 seconds in college football, and the crowd, you know, goes wild as this goes on, and they release balloons and all kinds of stuff happens. But at the apex of that hill is a plantation house that's open 7 days a week. And, you know, it's kind of a museum now, but it's right at the center of the campus. And so when I get here, you know, I'm kind of thinking that this is, I mean, it's odd, but, you know, there are also like these sort of these things that seem kind of poetic to me, but like also like tragic and uncomfortable because, well, you know, these, you know, primarily, you know, like black and brown bodies are running down this hill onto a field to labor. And at the top of the hill is this plantation house that we don't really talk that much about.
And this identity, this shared identity in this sort of orange where we leave out the black. And by the way, a black stripe. So there's a sort of added significance in all of that, where we construct an identity around this idea and then get to sort of claim it week after week, month after month, without, you know, and remaining blind to these other elements.
Yeah, and we end up calling it orange washing, or at least I did in the piece there.
I want to get to another clip here, too, right away. And again, you know, some of this, and you've even talked about the fact that, you know, there may be people who could find this offensive, some of what's in here. I want to play a clip now from a piece called Willie Revisited and come back and talk about it.
If Willie Lynch was just a myth, but his invention still persisted, would it matter if we saw ourselves as chattel and we battled one another? I was raised to hate my brother, so I hate him, and I hate the woman who created him. And maybe from a certain angle, if you strain to see the truth, then you can see that what it really is I'm dealing with has more to do with me. But I'm afraid of truth and hate that you remind me who I am, and that's related to the way I grew up, trying to understand how I could make it through this place and do what I was meant to and face the fact that I was snatched from home and brought to tend the land. Cause that's the complicated kind of truth. America the beautiful would hate to help me deal with. Plus I feel it's kind of mutually beneficial if I'm killing niggas and she want them dead as much as she wants me to go away. A bounty's on my head.
A clip from Willie Revisited, A.D. Carson's album and dissertation, Owning My Masters. He's here along with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Again, break that one down for us. You'll have to tell us, remind us who Willie Lynch is and the controversy over that letter and all of that and how it plays into what we just heard.
Okay, yeah, well, this actually came up in this Histories of Rhetoric class where we were talking about the origins of Rome, Romulus and Remus, and then, you know, I immediately go to you know, like Rome has an Uncle Remus, America has an Uncle Remus, and then like thinking about folktales, and then I mean thinking about how like this Willie Lynch letter or this history like operates kind of the way that folktales might, in that it gives us this account that's quote unquote historical. People are contesting it and thinking about it, but then we also have products. And so that clip that we just played it starts with if Willie Lynch was just a myth, but his invention still persisted. And then we get into this story that kind of ends with all of these things that people kind of look at the black community, you know, like with these pointing fingers and talk about, you know, like being the ills. And so it's really like kind of acting as if we can like really trouble that history more than just like think about it as something that's like automatically true.
Willie Lynch, this letter purported to be by a 18th century slaveholder who had instructions for how to maintain control over your slaves. There's a lot of controversy over the authenticity, fairly anachronistic. But again, your question is, you know, this thing is around. It's still an artifact and now is part of the culture, you know, whatever the perceived. What about Mark Anthony Neal? Again, the idea of this as part of the academic question as well as a legitimate source of artistic rendition.
I think it's important, right? Again, the way that Ninth Wonder and I have always done our class is that we look at hip-hop studies as a portal, you know, into American history. Many of the students who are taking the class, particularly some of the white students, you know, it's the first time they've ever had to deal with race in the context of 20th century American history. And so hip-hop does that, right? Hip-hop itself and sampling, you know, which you might think of as a citation practice, mm-hmm. you know, both in terms of talking about source material, but also historical reference in the context of that. And, you know, you can't think of like an introduction to African-American studies class in which students aren't having incredible debates around the Willie Lynch letter, the implications of it, its authenticity of it. What better way to have that conversation by using hip-hop as a means in which to have that conversation?
And no requirement to either authenticate or debunk. It's right. A question of this thing exists. What's the impact of that on our culture? We're talking today about African-American culture and popular culture. It's Back Channel on the State of Things with Mark Anthony Neal, Natalie Bullock Brown, and A.D. Carson is with us, doctoral candidate at Clemson University, and we'll be back with more of his dissertation, Owning My Masters, and more on the State of Things after this. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. Back channel today with Mark Anthony Neal, Natalie Bullock Brown, and Clemson doctoral student A.D. Carson, as we talk about A.D. Carson's doctoral dissertation, which itself was a heavily annotated rap album. And we've been talking, A.D., about the importance of the message and the platform. Then this project features a poem called Good Morning America, morning, M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G. You performed this song in Charleston the week after the massacre at Mother Emanuel AME Church in 2015. Tell us more about this poem and all of it, including a quote at the beginning from Ralph Ellison.
Well, yeah, you know, it's been the Invisible Man has actually been really influential for me thinking about this project, and particularly the narrator of that novel. And so I kind of thought about the idea of sleepwalkers and the danger. And, you know, we talk about wokeness now, you know, and many people come in to understand what might be going on around America. But, you know, the poem also like engages with Baldwin, you know, that the fire next time. And so in the poem, we kind of engage with like the idea that the next time is right now and America is on fire.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. No, I was going to say, well, we literally saw instances of America being on fire. And so, you know, like many people may have thought that after the massacre at Mother Emanuel, that something like that might be happening down in Charleston as well.
I'd like to play a clip from Good Morning America right here.
I remember that I'm invisible and I walk softly so as not to awake the sleeping ones. Sometimes it's best not to awaken them. There are a few things in the world as dangerous as sleepwalkers. This is the next time. Prepare for fire. The grotesque fantasy of the shrinking so-called majority. America's nightmare is slowly transitioning from somnolent slumber to a waking state akin to sleepwalking. America, for as long as it has existed openly, endorsed terror and rode the wave of fear that followed to superpower dominance domestically and abroad. To be clear, when I say America, I mean white America, the America America sees, wants to see, not the real America, but the ideal America, the America that stated all men are created equal while enslaving men and women who legally counted two-fifths less than their American masters. America, the beautiful, who crowns her good with brotherhood, but from sea to shining sea, shoots down and locks up young black boys and girls, men and women, with impunity. This is the next time. Prepare for fire.
That's a clip from the poem Good Morning America from A.D. Carson's album Owning My Masters. He joins us alongside popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal on this installment of Back Channel. There's another level of this in that particular clip, and that is actually performing this live and sort of being before a live audience. Tell us about that experience, A.D.
Well, it was a really... I mean, there were some complicated feelings there because it was also at the from the landing of the Confederate Museum there in Charleston. And then looking out over a crowd that's, of course, emotional because of what's just happened. And then, you know, speaking these words, I mean, to actually say to this crowd of people, prepare for fire. And then kind of think about the implication of those words. And I know that, you know, it's like really heavy and like could maybe even come off as like insensitive or like in working to incite something, as opposed to like really kind of reflect on what had recently happened in Baltimore and in Ferguson and, you know, lots of other communities where, you know, things were happening and people were just kind of feeling like, well, something big is going to happen in America in response to all of this stuff that's going on.
A.D. Carson is a doctoral candidate at Clemson University. His doctoral dissertation, it was a rap album called Owning My Masters. And A.D., I want to thank you so much for joining us on this edition of Back Channel.
Well, thank you so much. I really do appreciate it.
I'm also with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal on this installment, and I don't know if you want to talk more about that, but I know we can turn the corner here and move on and talk a little bit about the film Get Out, which is a box office smash and apparently broke a record for a debut film for an independent script. Let's talk a little bit about that. This social thriller, Get Out, it's a movie that features a black man who goes to meet his white girlfriend's parents for the first time in the suburbs, and things get a little bit suspicious. Let's listen to this section of the trailer.
Do you smoke in front of my daughter?
I'm gonna quit.
She'd take care of that for you.
How?
Hypnosis.
I'm good, actually.
Are you ready for this?
I'm back in the beat.
So look, I go do my research. Apparently, a whole bunch of brothers been missing in this suburb.
But it's cool.
Bro, how you not scared of this, man?
Couldn't see another brother around here.
Chris was just telling me how he felt much more comfortable with my being here.
Well, it's a clip from the trailer of Get Out. My guests are popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal, with us for another installment of Back Channel, connecting culture and context. Natalie, your feelings about this film?
Okay, so I just have to admit outright that I am still processing this film. But I think that there are parallels to what we were talking about just a few minutes ago with AD, and this issue of sleepwalking and its relationship to hypnotism, which is basically the vehicle through which everything that happens and sort of all the critique that comes through in Get Out takes place. Get Out messed with me because, there is so much going on, and it's not on the surface at all. And I think in American culture and with American movies, we've been so conditioned to have films basically tell us how to feel and what to think at every moment because of music and dialogue. And, you know, we're not really used to having to deconstruct symbolism and representation in the way that Get Out challenges us to do. But I think that when we if we just look at hypnotism and this idea of being woke, and the sunken place, and all these things that, spoiler alert, kind of come up through Get Out. I mean, I think it is a really interesting critique of where we are in this moment in American culture in terms of race relations. And I'm going to give credit to a friend of mine who had to help me like deconstruct this a little bit, but also the idea of like the good white person who really has, feels like they're not racist. They have no ill intent, but are very interested in appropriating not only black culture and different parts of black people, but the actual bodies, and body parts of black people. So it's doing a lot of work.
It's doing a lot of work. All that is happening, Mark, and it's a straight-up thriller. It works as a thriller, and that's part of its commercial success. Tell us more about this film.
You know, I'll admit that, by the time I saw the film, I'd heard so many kind of critiques of it being like the wokest film ever. So I don't think it's the wokest film ever. It is incredibly entertaining, right? And if we think about how we think about race in the context of horror and thriller, if we make the argument that Birth of a Nation was America's first horror film, right, it really does pick up on that tradition of this intersection of race and around terror and these things. What I think is fascinating about the movie, and this is something that, Natalie just raised, it really is a conversation about what Eric Lott calls love and death, right? This kind of love and hatred, for ambivalence about black bodies, right? And so, 300 years ago, we're talking about the exploitation of the labor, right? And you start to see this kind of notion that with this desire for the black body, it's like actually the desire to be embodied as black.
Right.
That, the focal point of the film is someone who's valued for his eyes, right, for the way that he frames the world as a photographer, to me is absolutely fascinating, because it is in fact that gift of second sight, if you will, if we think about Du Bois, that has been delegitimized, right, historically in terms of black folks. Like, I don't see what you're seeing, right? What are you talking about, right? And the fact that in the context of this film, it is in fact that second sight that is of most value,
right,
you know, in the context of the film.
Well, Jordan Peele, the writer and director, has also talked about another aspect of that, the kind of converse of that, which is the sort of, and this has been true in the trope in thrillers and horror films for a long time, and that is, you know, questioning the validity of the narrator. Is this, can we, is this a reliable narrator? And Jordan Peele talks about it in the tradition of Rosemary's Baby and other films that make you wonder if the paranoia is legitimate, if it is paranoia, or if you have a reason to be fearful about these things that you're seeing with your second sight.
I don't think black folks have ever had the opportunity to figure out whether or not it was paranoia. Just, I mean, it's listening to Eddie Murphy, you know, 25 years ago talking about the Amityville Horror and how you could never have black folks in that film, right? Because black folks would just get out the house, right?
Hence the
title of the film, yeah.
Right.
Well, let's listen to it. We talked about Jordan Peele. Here he is with Kurt Anderson and on WNYC's program Radio Studio 360 last month, talking about the film that he wrote and directed.
This movie, Get Out, was made in a lot of ways to address the lack of representation in horror movies.
Yep.
And a piece of that representation is the sort of sensibilities that a lot of, you know, you go to a black neighborhood, watch a horror movie, you'll hear a lot of people saying, Get out. So I wanted to make a movie that sort of addressed that, and in this movie, the lead, you know, if he doesn't make the smart decision, then at least you understand why.
That's a clip of director Jordan Peele talking with Kurt Anderson on Studio 360 last month, and I'm talking with Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. So again, this is a film that works. It's a straight up thriller, but to your point earlier, Natalie, for horror and thrillers to work, it has to address some latent anxiety that I feel. I mean, there has to be some fear that works for me. And Jordan Peele makes the point in a different interview about, for a long time, women were the protagonist because we could work through the fears that we tended to understand that a woman might have. How does this work again, for the first time in a horror film that we know of, an African-American protagonist?
Well, it's interesting because I think the latent anxieties of both the black protagonist as a stand-in for black people and the latent anxieties of white people looking at and experiencing black people are working in tandem. It's very interesting to experience the point of view of Chris, the main character, and to in the same way that horror films pull you in, and just as Jordan Peele was saying, you know, you're yelling at the screen, get out of the house, right? Don't go down that hallway. The things that Chris experiences when he goes into the garden, the garden party, for instance, and everyone is looking at him. He's the only, or he's one of two white people, I mean, black people, that are at this party. You know, we've all experienced that. If you're black, and you kind of traffic in certain spaces, you've experienced that, and you know what that feels like. And so you begin to, even if you don't literally start talking back to the screen, you're having a conversation with Chris, like, yeah, man, I know, you know, I get that, you know? And so I think that Jordan Peele has done something, you know, I'll use Mark's word. I think it's fascinating to be able to experience that type of engagement that a black character has in a white space in this type of genre in a way that, you know, we really haven't been able to before.
It's interesting to me, too, and almost ironic in that scene. The thing that struck me was in a way, in the way that journalists will, he's trying to be invisible. If I have a tape recorder or a camera, aha, right. No, I'm not one of you. I can be a part because I've got an excuse to be a voyeur. And he can't be. He right. can't be invisible even though he's hiding behind a camera.
You know, what I loved about the film is that it takes advantage of what we might call black mother wit. Every young black male has had a conversation, in many cases, if they had an African-American mother, about dating a white girl, right? Yep. And the dangers of that, right? And in the context of the film, it's his best friend, right? That parlays that mother wit. I mean, the whole time he's like, why would you do this?
Right.
Get
right.
out.
Right. 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 Right.
Why
exactly.
would you do this?
Exactly.
Right. And it's not just
yeah.
get out. It's like get the. Yeah.
Right.
That's right. We don't have too much time left. I do want to switch gears to talk about a very important documentary series that talks about the life and tragic death of Kalief Browder and his tragic story. I want to. Well, let's talk a little bit about that. It's on Spike.
Spike TV.
And
right.
tell us a little bit more about
Spike
it.
Spike TV, executive produced by Jay-Z. Kalief Browder's story went viral a couple of years ago when a young woman wrote about him in The New Yorker. This is a 16-year-old boy who was randomly arrested, ended up in prison for 3 years, was never given a trial, was in solitary confinement for 2 years, right? And the reason why this story is so important, I just sat in a doctoral dissertation defense yesterday, Dr. Austin Ash, and his work is about this. When we talk about blacks and policing and criminalization now, we talk about the 13th, right, on the one hand. So we talk about mass incarceration and we talk about police brutality, right? But most of the stuff that goes down is the random everydayness of those interactions, right? And Kalief Browder, right, is an example of that random everydayness of those interactions that eventually gets him in prison for 3 years for a crime that he always said he never committed.
And it was stealing a backpack that got him in solitary confinement,
right?
And
the pressure in terms of prosecutors and trying to make cases and plea bargaining and his refusal, right? In some ways, you could argue that the system eventually kills him, though he takes his own life. You can make the argument the system eventually kills him because he dared to push back against accepting the plea bargain.
Right. And, as a mother, I mean, one of the things that really hits home through this series and Kalief's story is the idea that it does not matter. You know, this randomness that Mark just talked about, this could happen to any young black male.
Right. Or female.
Or female, right. Okay. And so when there's quite a few talking heads in this documentary series that keep saying over and over again that the system is broken, it's broken, it's broken. You know, but it's broken on the backs of black folks, you know? I mean, it is literally, smashed over their backs. And Kalief Browder is such a tragic example of, you know, how this randomness and the fact that we have failed over and over again to reform our criminal justice system, to deal with the prison industrial complex, all of that,
And the visibility of his story didn't save him.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, that's the other piece of it. It's like everybody now knows about that, but that didn't save him.
And it airs as the Attorney General of the United States is going to make things apparently easier in police departments and release them from some of the oversight that had prevented some of this. Mark Anthony Neal, Professor of African and African American Studies at Duke, and Natalie Bullock Brown, who teaches broadcast media at St. Augustine's. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Back Channel. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.